do this. Okay, this is the resurrection class, apologetics session number 12. Oh, yeah, they're right in the back on that deal, and it says resurrection on the top. Okay, so we're on page 16, and we're also looking at this chart. So if you look on page 16, you'll see there item 5V, Roman numeral 5V, says hallucination. Everybody see that? Hallucination. And if you look now on your chart and look for the word hallucination on the bottom, on page 32, on the left side of your chart, it says hallucination kind of in the middle of that group. Do you see that? So what we're doing is we're looking at the alternative theories for the resurrection, and we have the tomb of Jesus at the top here, and it says it was either occupied or empty, and we're in the occupied alternative theories. So these people are claiming that the body of Jesus was still in the tomb. It's still there today. He's still dead. And here's how to account for the appearances. The people over here are saying, yeah, we agree with you, Christians. The tomb was, in fact, empty, but here's how we explain the empty tomb and appearances. So these people over here in the occupied tomb category, they don't even try to explain away the empty tomb. They say, no, the tomb is occupied. It's not empty. And so what we did last week is we looked at the charges against the evidence that we present, and we showed that those charges are inaccurate and faulty. And then we got into the alternative theories that people provide, which is this chart, to explain away the resurrection. And so we started last week, we looked at the unknown tomb, wrong tomb, legend, and twin theory. Okay? So we are at the hallucination part, and we're just moving from left to right on this chart. We're going to be covering that. Okay? So we're going to be looking at again, the alternative theories that explain away the resurrection, and we're going to be challenging those theories. We're going to be presenting evidence that challenges those theories to show that those theories do not stand up to scrutiny, and they're not based in reality, and therefore they ought to be rejected. And at the end of the day, what we come up with is this last theory over here, which is our theory, the supernatural theory, that says Jesus was bodily resurrected from the grave, and all of the data fits within this theory. So this theory has good explanatory power and scope. It explains things well and thoroughly and does the job. It has power and scope. It explains everything. It explains the extent of all the data that we have. And what we are finding, by the way, is that if you look at under each theory, there's a bunch of numbers. Those theories don't explain away the facts that I list that correspond to these numbers. So we'll get to that list towards the second half of the class tonight. And we're going to look at, like, every single number is related to a fact. And so we're going to look at each number, and we're going to list out the facts for ourselves, and then you can easily trace them back to this chart and say, these theories don't explain these facts, therefore they're faulty, and they have challenges that cannot be overcome. Does this line of argument make sense to you? Okay. Good, because I made it up myself. That's why I get paid the big bucks. And that's why your tuition is so expensive. So you could thank me in heaven by giving me some nice jewels so I could put in my crown. Does that work for everyone? You're like, this guy's nuts. All right. Okay, hallucination. Does anyone hold this view in the class? Are there any hallucinationists out there? Okay, there's one person you may be interested. In fact, sir, can you grab a book right there? It says Gerd Ludemann and William Lane Craig on the front of it. It's right there by your left hand. Anyway, it's Gerd Ludemann is a historian from Germany, top-notch historian, and he actually debated William Lane Craig. Does anyone not know who William Lane Craig is? Thank you. Okay, a couple people. So William Lane Craig is probably one of our best debaters. worldwide, Lane Craig, and he is a top-notch theologian and philosopher, and he debates atheists and agnostics all across the country, and he continues to do so. I actually watched him debate, and by the way, I learned this material from him, well, and a bunch of other of those books, but I took a class on the resurrection, which is his specialty in his research at Talbot. And so, in fact, I didn't even incorporate, because that class was so dense, because he's just focused in on the issue for so long, I didn't even have a chance to incorporate all that into the notes. So there's a whole lot more that I'll be even the next class on the next go-around in terms of bringing in all of William Lane Craig's stuff into this class. But some of it's here. But anyway, he debated Gerd Ludemann. Gerd Ludemann is a German historian, scholar, who holds to the hallucinationist view. So he would say that the disciples were hallucinating when they saw the appearance of Jesus, when they actually had a vision of Jesus, and Jesus' body was not actually there. So what they saw was a vision, a hallucination. And Gerd Ludemann goes on and on and on in the debate. And this book was basically a transcript from the debate, but the authors actually contributed more to it after the debate was over to kind of polish it up, but also add content and kind of make it really scholarly. It turns out that these guys debated each other a few times, and I actually was live at one of the debates in college. They came to my school, and it was really great to see. And there was a lot of atheists that came, and anyway, it was pretty awesome. And we got to see William Lane Craig debate one of the new atheist guys, Christopher Hitchens, at Talbot a couple years ago. That was a big debate as well on a not related topic, but he's just awesome. So if you're not familiar with his works, one of his main popular works was Reasonable Faith. It was written originally in the 80s, and it's one of the best apologetics books out there that covers a lot of this material, but a lot of other things. And he recently revised that, and it came out in a third edition recently, so I recommend looking for the third edition of Reasonable Faith. And getting familiar with his website, reasonablefaith.org. The guy's an expert on the cosmological argument, the resurrection theory. And when I say expert, I mean worldwide expert. And this is crazy. He's like top-notch in these areas. Cosmological theory, or resurrection evidences, and can't remember his other special. Oh, time. God, time, and foreknowledge. So the theology of God's understanding of how God relates to time or doesn't relate to time and things like that. So the guy is just unbelievable. Okay, so he debated Gerd Ludemann, who holds this hallucination view. So this isn't just a popular level view. Gerd Ludemann is, by the way, one of the experts in the New Testament, like kind of like Bart Ehrman, but he's not a Christian. He's a skeptic, but he's an expert in the literature of the New Testament. Okay, so here's some explanations. Here's what people on the street say. They were hallucinating, just like when we are smoking weed. We have visions of dead folks all the time, especially when we're on drugs. They say stuff like, they conjured up these dreams in the midst of their emotional despair, like many do when loved ones pass. Another thing they say is, they were so emotionally involved with the expectation of the risen Messiah that their minds projected hallucinations of Jesus. So these are fair claims, at least the last couple, that perhaps they were just so emotionally invested in this idea of a Messiah. They spent 3 years with him. They wanted him to be the Messiah, that they projected this view out of their emotional state of despair that they were in, that Jesus came back and talked to them. You know, maybe if you lost a loved one, perhaps you may know what that's like, and it may make sense to you. Now, what are the challenges with this view? Well, the disciples weren't expecting the resurrection, as they were depressed, shocked, scared, and misled. They considered his death as final, meaning it was over. It was done. Their little adventure with Jesus throughout Galilee has now come to a halt, and they have to go back to their boring lives as fishermen. and all their hopes and all their desires and all these exciting feelings are now just gone. So it was, they lost something tremendous that weekend. So they were kind of shocked, especially how it went down. And so they weren't really expecting Jesus just to pop up and appear, because they're in that temporary emotional state of depression. They knew the difference between vision and appearances. We have to remember that just because they were living in the ancient Near East or the Roman era, they weren't primitive in terms of mental capabilities. They knew the difference between visions and appearances, the appearances of a real person and a hallucination. They know how to distinguish between the two. Mere visions would not have led to a whole new Christian doctrine of the resurrection from a Jewish doctrine. Now, the Jewish doctrine of the resurrection had two components. One component is that the Jews thought that at the resurrection, when they thought of the resurrection, it meant at the end of the world, during the end times, there would be a corporate rising of all the righteous. So it was never thought from the Jewish perspective that the resurrection would include one person at one time in history. It would always be at the end of history, every righteous person will rise again. And that you can see easily in Ezekiel 37, where Ezekiel is prophesying to the dead bones that they may rise. And we see this graphic illustration of the dead bones having tendons and ligaments and flesh attached to them, and the valley of the dry bones rise up as a bunch of people. If you haven't read that, I really recommend it. Ezekiel 37, also in chapter 36, a little bit of background to it. And that's kind of the image that the Jews would have. They figured that everybody would just show up and rise, and that's why they put the bones of the dead in ossuaries, in little boxes, and the bones would stay there. They wouldn't deteriorate as radically and as quickly as the flesh would. And so after a year, the flesh would deteriorate. They would take the bones and put it in a little box called an ossuary. And so the idea was that the bones would be preserved in the same place as with the rest of the bones of that person, so that during the end times, Jesus could zap those bones and the flesh would grow back onto them and they would resurrect in bodily form. So that's one component, that it was a corporate resurrection at the end times, and it was the other component is that it was bodily in nature. Okay, so they would have thought, if this hallucination theory makes sense, they would have thought that Jesus' appearance was an appearance of a translated Jesus, not a resurrected Jesus, but a translated Jesus in heaven. Suppose he died, he was translated up to heaven, and what they saw was this figure of Jesus, but in the background was heaven, which they didn't really see, and they just saw this appearance of Jesus, and he was translated. Okay, so these visions, the point we're making here is that these visions, if it was a hallucination, though, they don't explain the new doctrine of the resurrection. We don't have a new doctrine developed called translation. We have a new doctrine developed called resurrection, which is a modified form of the Jewish doctrine. So the point we're making is that if they were hallucinating, how do you explain the new doctrine of the resurrection of the body of Christ, which developed, that occurred in history and of the body? And it doesn't make the hallucination theory doesn't make sense of the new doctrine that developed. Does that make sense? Point C, hallucinations aren't seen by groups. Simultaneous illusions are extremely unlikely. But there were more than one person gathered in many of the appearance accounts. So what we're saying is that it's very unlikely that we all would see a hallucination, you know, of a pink elephant over there in the corner of the room at the same time. It's extremely unlikely, actually. So simultaneous illusions are extremely unlikely. And what we find is that in the Gospels, it's not like Jesus appeared to one person at a time in a closed room and he kept redoing that. He appeared to the 12 disciples, he appeared to the 500, and they're all in the same room at the same time. So we have simultaneous appearances happening at once. Now, this morning, I woke up. I said, "Sarah, did you sleep well?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "I didn't sleep too well. I was kind of dreaming of some things, and it caught me off guard." She said, "I was dreaming too." I said, "Oh, did you have the same dream as me?" "No." I was like, "Oh, you didn't dream of the resurrection of Jesus like I did?" "No, I dreamed of some other weird stuff." So the point I was getting at is that the two people don't have the same dream at the same time. I couldn't, you know, in the middle of my dream, reach over and say, "Hey, come join my dream." That doesn't happen. Dreams are within the brain, and they happen internally, and other people don't have those same visions. So when you have a group of 12 or 500, the simultaneous hallucination hypothesis doesn't hold up. So point D, out of the 500 he appeared to, most would have had different levels of understanding of Jesus' teaching, different levels of commitment and connection to Jesus, and different presuppositions. It is unthinkable that they would have all hallucinated the same way. So in other words, if Jesus is appearing to us today, we all have different levels of commitment to Jesus. We all have different knowledge of Jesus. We all have different perspectives about Jesus, things that we like to emphasize about him and other things we don't. And so it's kind of unthinkable that we would all, and you know, we're all kind of in the same range of evangelical Christianity, but even us, it'd still be unthinkable that we'd all have the same hallucination of him. So it just fails to account for the different perspectives people have on Jesus and then having them have the same hallucination. Point E, Jesus had a transphysical body that they experienced on different occasions. So what do I mean by transphysical? Well, if you think about Jesus' body, what was it like? Jesus' body, we are told, was able to appear places immediately, transported, if you will, across space and time. But it didn't lose its physical form, did it? When he reached out to Thomas, Thomas was able to see and touch with his own hands. So transphysical is a word that I came across, and it really helps to understand the nature of the body. It wasn't just physical, and it wasn't spiritual. It was what I would call transphysical. And N.T. Wright and William Lane Craig used this term. And the other thing to note is that Jesus ate food. And the food, like we talked to think about last week, the food didn't just fall to the floor. It stayed in his stomach. And they didn't watch the food just sit in his stomach. Like, you didn't see this fish clearly, and then, like, the body of Jesus kind of, you know, transparent. And so we know that Jesus had a physical body, but it had some extra properties added to it, some extra X-Men-like capabilities, if you will. So Green Lantern, Superman, whatever. He had some mutant powers, if you will. And he was still able to do miracles and things like that. So it's best to use the term transphysical body. Okay? Any questions so far? Moving through. Now, so in other words, so basically overall, we can finish this point in saying this hallucination hypothesis has challenges that cannot be overcome. So we reject it. The next hypothesis, as you also see on your chart, moving to the next one, it says existential resurrection. Now, I don't want to spend any time on this because we have a lot to cover. So what I'm going to do is just basically tell you what this is saying. Jesus, the idea is that Jesus resurrected himself within us. We have an existential experience, kind of a, maybe the term new agey would help. We have a new agey experience of Jesus. He's resurrected in our hearts. He's resurrected in our minds. So in the disciples, he just resurrected to them and it made them feel better. And they were able to cope better. Stuff like that. That's kind of the idea with this existential theory. And I'm not even explaining it great, but quickly that's the best way to understand it. And it comes from the middle of last century where you had the big existential movement. You may remember that. And you have theologians who are actually going into the philosophical realms. We have theologians like Rudolf Bultmann and Paul Tillich, who were kind of known as existentialist theologians. So they would kind of wander into the existentialist philosophy that was around at the time. You may remember a person named John Paul Sartre, anybody know that person's name? And Martin Heidegger, people like that. Nietzsche was one, lived before that. And so these guys are known as the existentialists. And so it seems that the theologians of that middle of last century kind of took some stuff from their philosophies and let it shape their theology, namely Rudolf Bultmann and Paul Tillich. And so what you have then is kind of this weird New Agey resurrection theory of Jesus rising in our hearts. And so it just doesn't stand up to scrutiny when you look at the historical data. You can easily see this with the empty tomb and the appearance accounts. They actually had even if it was a hallucination, they had an appearance of Jesus out there, outside of their minds, that Jesus was out there, even though their minds was projecting it. So it wasn't like this internal thing like, oh, I have this internal experience of Jesus. He's living and dwelling in my being, and I'm so excited. It wasn't an internal, introspective look. It was actually extrospective, if that's a word. Is that a word, Christy? Probably not. Just the look on her face. So, but you get the idea. So the existential, she's an English major and master's, I think, as well. So she knows. And public author, very popular author, by the way. Look her up online. Anyway, welcome to you guys. We're on page 19. And we're also looking at this little chart. It's helping us walk through from left to right these views. So on the next page, we're at spiritual resurrection. Okay, so existential resurrection theory ought to be rejected. Spiritual resurrection. Now, this particular one I got really excited about, so I wrote about 5 pages of stuff on, but we're not going to go through that. I just happen to, you know, have all the coffee flowing sometimes and get really excited. So I'm going to skip a ton of it, and you can go back and read it on your own time. So you can draw a big line right after point D right here across the page and make a note to yourself, read on Saturday, or else Jeremy will shoot me in the face. Just kidding. So we're going to look at A through D, and then we're going to skip to the end and kind of clean it up at the back. Back part of this theory. So explanation. This is the spiritual resurrection theory. And the asterisk means that it was a view that was also held around Jesus' time, or in the first century. So Jesus' resurrection was only spiritual in nature and not physical. The body remained dead. Okay, so they're saying that it was a spiritual resurrection. The body was still in there. The view is currently held by the Jehovah's Witnesses, J-Dubs. In the past, it was held by some Gnostics and Neoplatonic philosophers. In the first few centuries, many Neoplatonic Greeks thought that the soul continues to live eternally in the divine one. After purification is completed through a series of reincarnations. So to explain, essentially all of this stuff is that the Greeks at the time, you know, you have the Platonic philosophers and then the Neoplatonic philosophers. And the Neoplatonic philosophers were kind of around in the 2nd and 3rd century, which is right when the early Christian theologians and apologists were also writing. So they had to interact with those ideas, just like we have to interact with the ideas in the secular marketplace today. So the Neoplatonic philosophers were the academics who wrote volumes of works, and their view was a modified form of Plato's view, thus the Neoplatonic term. And what they said was that the soul is something that continues to exist, and it is re-enters a new body every time it is reincarnated. And after that person, that body or soul is purified every time it's reincarnated, once it gets to the purification level, then it goes to exist in the divine one, in the ultimate non-personal being who exists in the world of forms, if you remember of Plato. So the divine one and the reincarnation view, does this remind you of any particular religion? Hinduism, was it? Mormonism, a little bit, yeah. And Buddhism, Nirvana. I don't know if that's Buddhism or Hinduism, actually. I think it's Hinduism. But some of these Eastern religions actually hold to this. So it's kind of interesting that Plato had a similar view. And, of course, these guys who followed in Plato's footsteps held a modified view of Plato. And what we're doing here is we're saying that, okay, well, how does Christianity respond to this? And the reason why I bring them up is because they were saying that Jesus' resurrection was could have only been spiritual. Because unless you come, the only way to come back is to come back in a new person, as a baby. Then you're reincarnated. You can't just have your body die and then be reincarnated or enter back into the earth without a body. You have to have a body. Because the whole idea of the Greeks and the Gnostics at the time was the body, the material world was bad, and the spiritual world was good. And so they said, once you get out of the physical, material world that's bad, you can go be with the good, divine one, that's non-personal. And so the idea here is that they were saying that Christians have a totally wacky idea because in order to come back into this world, you have to enter it back into it with a body, and you can only do that at birth. You can't do that after death. So I went to town on that to explain it for a few pages. So if you go to page 22 and continue this discussion, if you draw another line through your page right above D, this is in now the challenge part. We're in the challenge to the view. That was the explanation. So the first challenge that I'm going to tell you, there's other things that's above this for background, is that Augustine, who was a third century theologian, responded to these guys in his big book, The City of God, which I mentioned some of his response in the stuff above. But in summary, what he said was, he compared the Platonic and Neoplatonic views, and he shows that Christianity has the only view offering the soul's deliverance without going through a series of reincarnations, which could take forever. So Christianity has the only view offering the soul's deliverance. This will save your soul. You don't have to go through all these reincarnations. So this was made possible through the resurrection of Jesus. So he's basically witnessing to the philosophers of his time, and he's explaining to them, hey, I got something much better for you, and it's based in the reality of a resurrected Jesus. And Jesus did, in fact, resurrect. And the reason why Augustine is so adamant on this point, and the reason why he takes this criticism to heart, is because Paul did too. Paul was very adamant at correcting the Greek view, which was just kind of Platonic. It wasn't Neoplatonic during Paul's time. But Paul was battling the same view of the Greeks when he wrote to Corinth, which was where? In Greece. So Corinth was filled with a bunch of Greek thought, Greek philosophers. And what he does in chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians is he clears up the misconception. So item E, Paul contrasts the Corinthian Greek misconceptions and disdain concerning the afterlife. Paul deals with this apparent misunderstanding of the resurrection of the dead by delivering one of the most insightful theological passages in the Bible concerning the bodily resurrection of Jesus and the bodily resurrection, resurrected body of believers. Now, to pause here, I didn't put it there, but 1 Corinthians 15:53, I believe, is where it's at. And this is where Paul makes his famous remarks. The entire chapter of 1 Corinthians 15 is quite amazing at what Paul gives us concerning the nature of the resurrection that we will also experience. And Paul says that our bodies will also be transphysical in nature. He doesn't use that term, but that's essentially what he's getting at. And most people, when it's read, or most people read an NIV, and the NIV reads spiritual body. Spiritual body. So what he's saying there, when you actually look at the Greek, the spiritual part of that term, is thought to be something along the lines of transphysical. Okay? So we will have a body like his body, and it's a transphysical body in nature. So Paul was directly confronting, he was doing this on purpose because he knew the prevailing thought in Greece at the time was to deny any bodily resurrection understanding because they all held that the only possible way it could be done is a spiritual resurrection. So Paul attacked it as well in the New Testament. On that note, a spiritual-only resurrection would deny the Jewish understanding of what a resurrection was. And I'm just saying what I said before, that at the end times, it was bodily in nature. And so when the Jewish disciples, the last sentence, last couple sentences here under F, the Jewish disciples were communicating a bodily resurrection when they wrote and spoke. This is what their audience would understand. So when the Jews wrote, they wrote to a Jewish audience most of the time, except for Paul when he traveled around to the Gentiles. But in the Gospels, they used the term resurrection. They didn't use the term translation, and they didn't use the term spiritual resurrection, or they didn't refer to it that way. So, and then I make the same point here that I made in the hallucination theory, that additionally Jesus ate food and was touched by others, and these physical experiences rule out a spiritual resurrection. So those scholars and popular skeptics that would claim a spiritual resurrection is what took place, they fail to account for several things. One, the terms used by the early church, like Augustine, and the first disciples, Paul and the disciples in the Gospels, and also the nature of Jesus' body was one that could eat food and so on and be touched. Any questions? Okay. Empty tomb theories. So now we're moving on to this side of the chart. Empty tomb theories. Jesus wasn't, his body wasn't there. So how do we explain the empty tomb? So the first thing that is, the first theory that we're looking at is disciples stole the body. On the left there, under natural. So they have natural explanations, and then we have a supernatural explanation. The first natural explanation is the disciples stole the body. And that's what we see here on page 23 under empty tomb theories. Disciples stole the body. Item 1, explanation. A, honestly, anybody can break into a tomb and steal a body. We do it all the time. And believe it or not, this actually did happen back then. So I'm not just being funny here. Apparently, people did do this because maybe they wanted perhaps some of the treasures, family heirlooms that bodies were buried with at the time, not just in Egypt, but all over the Mediterranean. So tomb raiders was apparently a common thing. Just ask Laura Croft, for instance. Part B, the disciples stole the body while the guards were sleeping. Okay, that one's an asterisk. So this was held, propagated by the Jewish authorities at the time. That's what I'm saying in C. Challenges. What are the challenges to this view? Does anything come to mind before you look down there on your page? Anything first pop up like, ah, I see something wrong? Just tell me if you do. If not, that's okay, because I'm going to give you the information. Okay. Okay, item A. A large stone was rolled in front, making it difficult to move. So this is a challenge that this theory cannot overcome. How does Jesus, or how did the disciples move this large stone back up where it was placed? William Lane Craig thinks that the stone was more circular in nature and kind of like a cylindrical disc, and it was rolled down a little groove that had been cut in the rock and kind of gently, you know, snug against the other wall, and then it blocked the entrance. That's one view. And another view could just be it was a huge boulder that was placed in front of the opening. Now keep in mind, the tombs probably were not as easily ADA compliant, handicap accessible. They were probably something you had to climb into a little bit, and it may have been actually something in the ground vertically. So there's a lot of different ways we can understand the tomb of Jesus. When the Gospels describe it, they say that they peeked in and then went in. So it wasn't maybe as if it's a big old door opening like that. They just kind of like, oh, he's not there. They probably had to get in there and look. And keep in mind, it may have been bright outside. So they may have had to let their eyes adjust as they peered in. So the opening may not be that big. Just to give you a feel, so you can understand the differences in that area and that era. When I was over there, I learned that it was quite possible that in Nazareth, where Jesus was born, he was born perhaps in something underground, or their home that they lived in was underground, and they entered it, you know, vertically, and it was kind of like this underground area, and you know, there's like an area to cook and maybe something going up to ventilate it, and maybe like basically a couple rooms, but it was all mud around you. So I don't know if that's true, but they built this massive church over the top of these things. I think they call them grottos, I'm not sure. And the church spans over this entire region. Structural engineering-wise, it's a marvel, and it was quite impressive because you go into the church. We went in while they were having Mass, and they actually have a Catholic church there, which is quite cool, in Nazareth. And you look down through the big opening in the middle of the church. The opening in the middle of the cathedral is about the size of this whole area. And you can just kind of peer in, and all you see is a bunch of dirt holes and maybe some things that they... you know, they discovered essentially archaeologically, and they just kind of left it open for you to see. And they think that's where Jesus' house was when he grew up. And so it was quite fascinating. I mean, you're just in this huge cathedral, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, there's Jesus' birthplace, and it's really cool. So anyway, things may be different than we think when we think about all this stuff that happened in the Gospels. And what it looked like. Okay, so a large stone was rolled in front. A seal was placed on it, deterring any persons to tamper with the body and or face punishment by the authorities. So a seal was placed on the tomb. We read that in the Gospels. And if anybody was to tamper with it, they would have to face punishment by the authorities. So that would have, you know, kept the disciples away. Now, another point was that there were guards. Now, this is extremely important. There were Roman guards there, and the challenge that that we are given from this fact in history that there were guards is that it would have been improbable that the Jewish disciples overtook Roman guards to raid the tomb. It's very unlikely that that took place. Severe penalties would have been imposed on the guards for sleeping on duty. This would have deterred the guards from sleeping. So they knew they would be punished if they were caught sleeping on duty, and so the guards probably weren't asleep. If some of the highly disciplined guards were sleeping, the others most likely would have been on watch. So there's a few there sleeping, three are awake, something like that. The Jewish authorities were thinking that the disciples were going to steal the body. So this was already in the mind of the Jewish authorities of the time. They had just had a successful mob party, you know, to get Jesus crucified. Pilate agreed, and so they're excited about that. Later on in that day, they said, hey, Pilate, good job. Let's guard the tomb so that the disciples don't go steal the body. Now, what I'm saying here is even they knew Jesus' predictions about rising again 3 days after his death. They did not want another deception to occur, as his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he had been raised from the dead. And they said, this last deception will be worse than the first. So they were very aware of this, and they did not want Christianity to break out and explode like it did. They didn't want to have that mess to deal with. So the Pharisees went to ask Pilate to make the tomb secure. And Pilate agreed, ordering the Pharisees to go and make the tomb secure with a guard. I think that could be plural. So in underline there, I'm saying they knew where the tomb was and made it secure and sealed it. And again, the Pharisees and the Roman guards knew exactly where it was. Okay, this is very important. We saw last week that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus put Jesus' body in the tomb, and the women followed and watched where it was. The other people that knew where it was were the guards and the Pharisees, essentially the enemies of Jesus. So a lot of people knew where the tomb was. So listen to what it says. Matthew 28:11-15. While the women were on their way, some of their guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests, everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, this is right after the angel came and Jesus rose from the grave. So this is, they go back into town. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep." So the authorities are telling the guards what to say. Fabricate a lie, essentially. "If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed by the Pharisees. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. This is written in our Gospels. It's a great thing for us. It's an apologetic. So to kind of hash this out, a possible conversation could look like this. Christian, Jesus is alive. Jew, no, the disciple stole his body. Christian, the guard at the tomb would have prevented any such theft. Jew, well, the guards were asleep. Christian, the chief priest bribed the guards to say this, and the guards fainted when the angel came. So the Christian already has an answer for the Jew. And the Jews, you know, had that argument. And so we see here an apologetical conversation going back and forth right after the resurrection. I mean, immediately after. So people were already trying to explain away the resurrection before it even happened. We're going to brace ourselves to explain away this resurrection because we don't want any weirdness unfolding. We don't want this fake Messiah to get crowned Messiah, essentially, forever, which is what happened. So the debate about the disciples stealing the body while the guards were asleep is not a modern one, but it took place as early as the morning of the resurrection. But the most interesting and obvious fact that is revealed by this very debate and controversy is that the tomb is empty. Both the Pharisees, guards, and Christians all confirm an empty tomb. The Pharisees and guards do so, but lie as to why it was empty. But they don't create a lie to cover up that it was empty. So you have enemy attestation that the tomb was empty. You have the enemy confirming this fact. It's not just something the Christians made up to propagate their view. You have the enemies of Christianity creating a scenario, blocking the tomb from the disciples stealing the body, trying to make sure Christianity doesn't break out. Then it actually happens. They can't control Jesus. They can't contain him. Jesus resurrects. And then you have this issue of them still lying and saying that the guards fell asleep and the disciples stole the body. So it's, you know, they're doing everything they can to stop the explosion and emergence of Christianity. And they couldn't do it. And it turns out that they are actually helping us, even with their efforts, to prove our point and to prove that Jesus was the Son of God and actually rose again by agreeing to the fact that the tomb was empty. So it was never a debate, you know, is it occupied or empty? Everybody knew it was empty, even the authorities, the enemies of Jesus. The question in item 11 there, so the question was always, what happened to the body? Not was the tomb empty or occupied. It was always, where did the body go? What happened to Jesus' body? Who took it? It's missing. So people are affirming the empty tomb here. So the skeptic who says that the disciple stole the body is still affirming the fact that the tomb is empty. Okay? So this alternative theory that the disciples stole the body has challenges that cannot be overcome. You have the enemy attesting to the fact that the tomb is empty, and it's highly improbable, as we saw, that the disciples would steal the body. In fact, we know according to this lie that was fabricated, that none of that actually took place because they fabricated the lie. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Second question, no, we don't know outside of the Bible that that's what actually took place. But the interesting thing is that the disciples put that in there because most likely that's what took place. We have good evidence based on the context of that those passages that a bunch of things were reported which were rather embarrassing in nature and indescribable other than with any other theory than the theory that Jesus rose from the grave. So we know there's some historicity in that chunk of text. So this particular text with this little dialogue between the authorities and the guards, we can say that's historically accurate because the surrounding stuff is also historically accurate. Well, apparently the Jewish authorities, you know, made the governor happy so that he wouldn't punish the guards. That's what they're saying here in that passage. We'll handle the governor. You take care of this lie. Here's your money. Everything will be cool. And that's what they did. So we have good reason to believe that that is true. Another thing is we don't have any other document from the Jewish authorities at the time explaining it differently. So it's logical that that's what they would have done anyway. They wouldn't want Christianity to break out. And they wouldn't want the disciples to steal the body. So it's a logical thing that that took place. You can read more up on that particular point of the disciples stealing the body or not stealing it and some of the books I have in the back. Some of these guys spend chapters on some of these points, and it gets to be pretty laborsome. But to your other point, they went to Home Depot and got some caulking and sealed it. Just kidding. It was probably not a seal, like watertight. It was probably more like some sort of sign or some sort of, round or something Jewish in nature that had maybe some written material on it saying, do not tamper with this tomb or you will be punished. You know, it was probably like one of these Jewish symbols on it. And then you knew that that was from the Pharisees. It had a Jewish symbol. Maybe like we would put an American flag on something and put some words on it. Maybe someone would say that's an American seal. You know, what's that with all the candles? What's that? Okay, yeah, maybe something like that. It had all the candles and Star of David or something like that. You know, some symbol. Yeah, yeah. And you knew it was official because it was from them. Question? Yeah, this is a great point. Let me comment on it. What were you saying, Christy? That was a great point.
Wouldn't they have wanted to punish the disciples then? Because if the tomb said, you know, don't mess with it or you'll be punished, and then they did mess with it, wouldn't they logically, if they said the disciples, then, like, take them to jail?
Yeah. That's a great point, too. We don't have any signs saying that the disciples were then carted off to prison because they were accused of stealing the body. So they faced 3 years of jail time. We don't have that. In fact, what we have is the disciples running around looking at appearances of Jesus, and then all of a sudden Pentecost comes and they start preaching like crazy. So the authorities really didn't believe that the disciples stole the body. Otherwise, there would have been some ramifications. So that's another point to it.
The guards were not actually asleep, so they knew the disciples were there.
And that's another point. So you have two people that knew exactly that that lie was fabricated. They were making it up. And so therefore, they weren't going to go, you know, be the district attorney and punish the criminals. To your point, though, that is a great point, is that if the authorities knew the disciples had the body, they somehow would have got the body and carted it around town. Said, here, Jesus is dead. Ha ha. And look at the next point. You just said this right now, but if look, it's right here on the outline. The authorities hid the body. This is another theory. It's the next theory over on your chart. So the explanation is the Jewish authorities hid Jesus' corpse to keep the disciples from stealing it. So this is a little different scenario, but similar, that the Jewish authorities hid the corpse so that the disciples wouldn't have the chance to steal it. But the challenge to this theory is that this wouldn't make sense in light of the fact that producing the body would dissolve all resurrection preaching. So all you have to do is show the body if you're the authority who hid the body, and therefore Christianity is now cut off at the root. Okay, let's take a quick break and come back, and we'll keep plowing through this. See you in 5 minutes. Sound good? Thanks. Yeah, he does it rhythmically. Yeah. Yeah, he even gives like some devotional stuff somehow. It puts that in at the end. And it's just like, how did you time that up, you know? So anyway, okay, so we're looking at the bottom page 26 of 40 and the swoon theory. Does anybody know what the swoon theory is? What is it? Jesus wasn't really dead. Thank you. So swoon is kind of similar to like fainting, being in a coma. What's that? Okay. And so item B, next page, Jesus didn't actually die. This is the view that says Jesus actually didn't die, but merely fainted and went into a light coma. Right before the coma, he was given some liquid on a sponge to help him survive. So this, you know, when they put up on the stick a sponge with some vinegar, you know, that was actually some treatment for him to kind of push through this and just go into a coma. And they say that the cooling temperatures and ointments from the women who wrapped his body, I think it was more, not women, but Joseph and Nicodemus, wrapped his body, provided favorable conditions for a quick recovery. Thus, Jesus merely was resuscitated from the coma he was in. Okay, so Muslims hold this view. They've been holding this view for hundreds of years. But recently, the Western world has also attached onto this view. And it was made popular by this guy, Carl Venturini. And basically what this view is saying, let me rephrase. Other views include that Pilate was bribed to take him off the cross early, and Jesus was taken down from the cross within 6 hours, and the centurion didn't break his ankles. So he didn't die on the cross, but he died elsewhere, and that's why we see a shrine in India that marks his burial. Okay? So that's one way to put it, is that Pilate took him down off the cross early, the Roman guards didn't break his ankles, just like it says in scriptures, and he died. He didn't live forever. He just died somewhere else. And some people think he went to India and he died there. And that's why there's a shrine in India to Jesus, because they think he traveled his way over to India. And then he died there. James Cameron recently directed a documentary, you may remember this, on the ossuary containing the bones of Jesus being found in Jerusalem in the same tomb as Mary Magdalene, implying that he died later on and he is still dead. So he didn't die on the cross, but he died somewhere else, because he survived the cross. So this kind of goes along the swoon theory idea. Does anybody remember seeing the James Cameron documentary that came out a few years ago? All this hype and publicity. Jesus' tomb is found, and James Cameron went on to write a book about it. James Cameron was the director of Titanic, if you remember. So he made this very, very popular. He knows. He probably continued working as a carpenter, married Mary Magdalene, and thought they'd go on a road trip and got in a car accident in India because the traffic's bad. And then there's... Yeah, he's like, okay. Yeah, I hung out for 40 days. Hung out for 40 days and said, you know, guys, this got me in trouble. I got crucified. I'm done with this. You take it from here. Mary, let's go. Honeymoon. So that's one view. So the challenges to this view are many. Pilate also doubted his death. Okay, so we have in the Bible someone who doubted his death, and the disciples were sure to put this in there to attack that perspective that said that Jesus didn't die. They knew that there was going to be a challenge like this at the time. And so Pilate was surprised to hear that he was already dead. Summoning the centurion, he asked if Jesus had already died. When he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. And so Pilate, a non-Jew and a non-Christian, was satisfied that Jesus died after receiving confirmation. So Pilate himself doubted, I don't think Jesus is dead. Why don't you guys go make sure? Because Joseph of Arimathea went to him and said, hey, Pilate, can I have the body? And he's like, I don't know. I don't believe you. I think you're just trying to steal his body, and he's not really dead. Then the guards come back, say, yeah, he's dead. We pierced him in the side. Okay, so Pilate was convinced he was dead, and we have medical doctors and PhDs all around the world. They've studied the Roman crucifixions. Some have been sample crucifixion experiments, meaning, I didn't say it right, but some have even tried to be crucified themselves, just to find out what it was like. And the doctor tried it, and one doctor even wrote Jesus Christ's death certificate. So you have doctors going through the motions to kind of find out what would happen to the body. A doctor apparently tried it, not probably with the holes in the hands, but just hanging there. And the cause of death isn't commonly known as asphyxiation. And he was also speared through the right lung into the heart when John tells us that blood and water flowed out. And medical science has shown that Jesus could not have survived the scourging and crucifixion. So a few guys got together, they were doctors in the 80s, and they wrote a journal article and submitted it to the American Medical Association, the scholarly journal. And this quote right here is what they said. And basically, if you read it, skim through it, you can see that they're using a lot of big words, and they're talking about a lot of, you know, bodily activity that takes place during the process of Jesus' dying. And you can see here that it all makes sense and it flows. And we have a medical diagnosis of what happened within Jesus, biologically speaking, that led to his actual death. You could skip. Okay, F, it says, basically you could just skim through that. Item F, a new word was made called excruciating, meaning out of the cross, to describe the pain and the bodily torment that takes place when someone dies on a cross. So surviving the cross after extreme beating is highly unlikely. A medical doctor was asked, was it possible in any way for Jesus to have survived? He says, absolutely not. And this is a different medical doctor than the other three guys that wrote that article in the 80s. He says, absolutely not. It's impossible. Again, there is no way he could have survived the cross. So he's trying to make it very clear to us that he definitely died and no one could survive. Another thing to think about with this alternative theory, another item of evidence to bring up, is that if Jesus didn't die, he would have looked horribly beat up from the torturing that happened before the cross and the cross itself. He would have had a crown of thorns and a spear hole in his side, and this half-dead Jesus showing himself beaten and bruised would have prompted the disciples to help him get rest and take medicine. So the disciples would have been like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you survived. Are you okay? And Jesus is stumbling around like, I feel terrible. I just got tortured. And the disciples' belief that he resurrected would never have happened because he would have been a mess. So they would have scrambled to get a medical attention. They would not have started thinking, all right, you resurrected, and got excited, having their sorrow become joy. But they did in fact believe that he resurrected, and they preached it with enthusiasm. So there is no way they would have pronounced the resurrected Messiah, Savior of the world, who conquered death and had a renewed body, if he didn't really die, and especially if he appeared to them half dead anyway. So keep in mind that the disciples were utterly disappointed and grieving before the news came from the women, but we see a radical, vibrant, and excited group just 50 days after the crucifixion, and such excitement would not have come from a half-dead Jesus. And so another line of thought here is that Jesus was most likely wrapped in 75 pounds of spices and bandages that Nicodemus brought to the tomb. And when they wrapped him, it would have been heavy, and it would have been hard for a dead, tortured Jesus who just got beat up and his side pierced with a spear to work his way out of the bandages, rise up, move the stone itself, and overcome the guards, and then escape and moving on to do what he did, moving on to go on his honeymoon with Mary Magdalene. So it's very hard to believe that, right? Make sense? Well, so it turns out that if you do a statistical analysis of all the names that were around at the time of the first century, Jesus was very common, because it's Yeshua, Joshua. James was common. Joseph was common. And somebody did a statistical analysis right after this documentary came out and found that there's like a 1% chance, let me back up. There's probably about 12 people or more around with the name Jesus in Jerusalem around that time, based on the statistics and the probabilities. So I think it was like a 1 in 12 chance or something that this could have been Jesus' bones. And then you couple that with Mary Magdalene being found in there too, because it doesn't actually say Mary Magdalene. It says, I think it actually says Martha or Martha or Marth or something like that. It doesn't actually say Magdalena or something. So you could interpret it that way. And I think it had some children's bones too, I'm not sure. And so when you add, even though Mary was a common name, oh, that's the other thing. Mary was a common name because it did say that. And so when you add, maybe it was Mary Magdalene, then the probabilities decrease even some more. So then you're left with like a less than 1% chance that it was Jesus' bones. And they're thinking it was dated in the first century. They could be wrong. So it could be before that or after that. You know, the carbon dating stuff, there's a little bit of play there. So there's this very, very, very small chance it was Jesus' body or bones. Yeah. It was a family ossuary, I think, of Mary. I think it said that.
There was a Joseph, there was a Mary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right.
And there was a child.
Right.
But it was in Jerusalem and not Nazareth.
You would think they'd be Mary. Yeah, so there's some issues with it. Okay. Yes, sir. That's a good point. Yeah.
So, if they're all lies and delusions,
Right, exactly. So the disciples went on to say, no, he resurrected. And what you're saying is they would be lying.
They'd be lying, and they must be lying, or it would seem amazing if they weren't lying, that he predicted that he would rise from the dead, and then it just so happens that he didn't die.
Right.
Yeah,
the fact alone that he survived a cross is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Now, it does... Sorry? Yeah, his back getting ripped open. Yeah. Exactly, and the Passion, the Mel Gibson movie, he really shows it. Oh, okay.
They actually think he's resurrected, but he tricked them all.
So, you know, this is a rebuttal.
So Jesus loved and did
not. Ah, another response. So, look, we're having some back and forth here. All right, guys, this is great. So, yeah, this is good thinking here. So, that Jesus would be lying, the disciples would be lying, and your original point that all of what happened before that, Jesus' miracles, him calming the sea, walking on water, raising the daughter to life, healing people all over the place. What about all that? Do we just ignore that? How do we explain that? So you still have a Messiah, Son of God-like figure that is amazing when you start understanding him and what he was about and what he taught. So how do you explain all that? The virgin birth. So there's a whole lot to explain that that theory doesn't account for. Just the fact that he didn't die. Then that person who holds that theory has to explain all this other data, which he doesn't. He just says, no, Jesus didn't really die, and he moves on. Therefore, Christianity is not true. So you still have a lot of other stuff that person has to account for that he never really does. And if he does, his name is usually like Richard Carrier or Bart Ehrman or some of these guys, and then you got to read all their books. Yeah.
Yeah, and just to this point, I feel like someone would have written about that anyway, like if he didn't actually die, because that's like a pretty scandalous story in and of itself, that like this crazy man came, said all this stuff, did all this stuff, mm-hmm. and died, raised again, then did it. Like that makes an awesome story too. So I feel like that would have been written down by someone somewhere, you know, because it's just so fascinating. Like, that is so ridiculous.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating story. He survived this thing, and then he ascended to heaven. So we have that data too. It says he ascended to heaven. So even if he didn't die, he still ascended to heaven. You know, so, okay, well, you still got some guy rising up into the clouds. Do you not worship him as God? I would, you know. Oh, so you're saying they bring this up because he still has nail holes in his arms. That's why they bring it up. Well, probably I would say more so that he was only on the cross for 6 hours. That's probably why. It's like, hey, he's only on the cross for 6 hours. He didn't really die.
He still had the wounds, though. Did he know Thomas?
What is...
He wasn't looking beat up.
If he's looking beat up here, why doesn't he look up beat up in other places?
Yeah, if he took off his shirt, he may have still had the... Yeah. I think he did. Because it says when he showed Thomas the scars in his hand or the holes in his hand, I can't remember what it says. But I think he did. Because it says that, and think about this. When we're in heaven for eternity, because Jesus' transphysical body was ascended, those scars most likely did not just disappear, and he still has them to this day in heaven. And when we get there, we're going to see them for ourselves, and forevermore, we will always see those. And I think we will, as a reminder of how we all got there. You know, when he does this, we're just going to be like, thank you, Jesus, forever and ever and ever. And That's something powerful about the resurrection. It has implications personally for us. And we'll talk about implications of this when we get to the back end here on page 40, but we may not get there tonight. So there's two other theories I want to present to you. Again, we're walking through this chart, Passover plot, and Jesus was an alien. Okay, so Passover plot we're going to skip because I don't even understand it myself. And you can see the twin theory challenges above. It's essentially something weird, like there's a young man who appears on the scene, and the young man is described as the risen Lord. Who is this young man? Where does he come from? It kind of is similar to the twin theory that we went through. And so, it has challenges, so I'm saying just refer to the twin theory. Because we don't know where this young man comes from, and it seems just so conjured up that there would be some young man who apparently looks like Jesus, and the disciples think that's the risen Jesus. So the Passover plot, this conspiracy thing, is just weird, and I don't know of anybody who, besides this guy, Hugh Schoenfield, that holds it. Jesus was an alien. This is perhaps the most powerful skepticism and criticism used against Christians. Christians do not have a response for Jesus was an alien. I'm sorry to tell you, we lost. So let's just pack our bags and go home. So to explain this theory, I'm saying item one here, self-explanatory. To challenge this theory, I'm saying none required. Moving on. So this is the theory, Jesus was an alien. Do we need to spend time on it? No. Okay. Now, if you skip the page there, turn the page, we are on page 31, and this, again, relates to this chart. So if you look at all the numbers below here on your chart, they all correspond to this list of facts in bold underlines. So I'm listing them here, and every number corresponds with these numbers. So you can go home and kind of cross-reference this table to this list and see how they match up to each other, and it's actually kind of cool that these theories don't account for these facts. That's what it says at the bottom. Numbers correspond to the known historical facts that do not fit the theory. That's what it says at the bottom of the chart, and this is where you go. So we're going to just quickly look at this. Can I have a volunteer read through these 12 facts? Would anybody be willing? Just read them out loud. Let's say fact number one, blah, blah, blah. Ryan, thanks.
Fact number one.
Oh, Christy? Okay, why don't you guys switch off? You be even, you be odd. Make it fun. Thank you so much. You too, I appreciate that. You know, we read through these. They're quite profound, each and every one of them. And these are facts that we can say that we hold as Christians, but we also have non-Christian scholars who also hold these facts to be true. So each one has a scholarly attestation, some more than others, some more than others, okay? So these are the facts that we gather from the scriptures. We can read the scriptures and pull this out. And when we do, we create a very, very, very strong case for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I was debating when I put this outline together to put this list up at the top of the outline and go over it first. basically presenting our persuasive case for the resurrection. Here are positive evidences that show why our view that the resurrection actually happened is a rational view to hold. And then start attacking the criticisms, and then start challenging the alternative theories. I decided to do it opposite and leave these at the back because I wanted to kind of knock theirs down first. But my point in doing that was presenting them in their best possible light to not create a straw man argument and knock down the straw man, but to give them the benefit of the doubt and show maybe how their theory or charge is rational and reasonable, but that they have failed, in my opinion, to present something rational and reasonable. So here we have 12 facts that present a case. When taken together, they build up a good argument for the plausibility and the likelihood that Jesus actually rose from the grave. So when you read through them, you may want to read through them again on your own time. Spend some time just thinking about each one. And each one is very hard to deny from a historical point of view. And the scholars who deny these, they struggle to do it. They have to really push the information they have to its furthest possible limit to deny one of these. So each one stands on its own merits. It has its own strengths, and they're highly plausible, historically speaking. In the next page, we see that all alternative theories fail in explanatory power and scope to account for all of these facts. Thus, we have seen that the alternative theories explaining away Jesus' resurrection have challenges that cannot be overcome. So in light of these facts, okay, none of these theories work. They don't account for these facts. These facts present challenges that can't be overcome by that theory, so that theory loses because of these challenges. And these are the challenges. These are the facts that if we have other theories come up in the future, they have to account for these facts because these facts are highly evidenced in history. Now, the third line of reasoning we have here in page 33, awesome. Okay, so we got a few more minutes and we'll close. The evidence provides a compelling case for a historical resurrection event, which is the theory with the most explanatory power and scope. So again, these facts you could easily throw in right here after this point, but I put it there just so you can see how it corresponds with that table. But we don't even need to use all 12, and that's why I didn't put it under this line. We don't need to use all 12. Because some scholars don't like some of these facts, we can say, okay, scholars, if you don't like those facts, we won't use them. But it turns out that a lot of scholars agree on most of the facts. In fact, most scholars agree on at least 5 of them. So if you go with the minimal facts approach by Gary Habermas, all you need to do is present these 5. And these 5 facts are attested by most scholars. So Gary Habermas, I mentioned last week, him and William Lane Craig and N.T. Wright are probably our best experts, apologetically speaking, on the resurrection. And they do such a fine job in their research that, like I said last week, he spent 20 or 30 years with his grad students, and they basically researched over the last 20 or 30 years, all of the scholarly data and scholarly journals that they can find, and they said, how many scholars attest to how many facts? And it turns out that more than 75% of 2,000 scholars, or I think it 75% of scholars, so about 2,000 of them, agree that these facts happen, more than 75%. So maybe on fact number 1, you may have 95% of scholars saying, yeah, that happened, or something like that. But you at least 75% of scholars, so at least 2,000 scholars out of maybe, 2,500 scholars, non-Christian and Christian alike, say these facts actually happened. That is a huge, huge thing. So they say, this is what they say. We agree, so you can say this when you're presenting an argument, that most scholars agree on at least these 5 things. And it turns out from these 5 things, we can get to the resurrection quite easily. Fact number 1, Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Fact number two, Jesus' disciples believed that he rose and appeared to them. Fact number three, conversion of the persecutor Paul. Paul was a persecutor of Christians. He was converted by an appearance of the resurrected Jesus. So he wasn't already a Christian. He was bashing and killing Christians. But he converted, so that's a big fact. And most scholars attest to that. Conversion of the skeptic James, the brother of Jesus, who was a skeptic. He was converted to the faith when he also believed he saw the resurrected Jesus. And fact number five, Jesus' tomb was empty. So with these minimal five facts, we can develop and infer the resurrection. I'm down there on point seven. That's the most plausible theory, and it has the most explanatory power and scope. Okay? And skeptical scholars do not like this argument because these are the facts they agree on, but it leads to the conclusion that Jesus resurrected. So if you're a secular scholar and you said, yeah, I agree on that, I agree on that, I agree on that, and then you walk away, and Habermas says, wait a minute, and you're the skeptical scholar, and you say, what? He says, this means that you would infer that Jesus resurrected from these facts. And they don't like that conclusion. But that's what they get. And so it turns out that this is a very, very compelling argument. Because when you have people that are skeptics of Christianity, non-Christians, or maybe enemies of Christianity who bash it, agree on these things, then you still have the resurrection, even with these minimal facts. So Habermas says that this argument has shocked a generation of scholars. He uses the word shocked because he, based on his interactions in the scholarly circles and academia, he has realized, based on their responses, that they're shocked by this argument because they agree to this stuff, but the conclusion they disagree with. But that conclusion is the most logical. It's easily inferred, and this creates a very, very strong case. Next page. Suppose you don't want to use the minimal five facts approach. Suppose you have the 12, you don't want to use that. Suppose you don't want to use the 5, that's fine. Okay, well, even though the 5 is a great argument, suppose you only want to use one fact. What's this? Okay, suppose you only want to use one fact. Okay, here it is. This is used by William Lane Craig and N.T. Wright. And we'll cover this page and we'll stop here. Okay, this is a great strategy. I don't recommend it because there's a lot of good other stuff. I would recommend starting with the 12. And if you get into problems in your conversation, go down to the 5. And if you still get into problems, go down to the 1. But most of the time, the 12 are going to be so convincing, and everything you're talking about with the 12 are going to blow people away. Unless you get to someone who's kind of more skeptical, more knowledgeable, then you can use the 5 and say, look, 2,000 scholars, Christian and non-Christian, say these 5 work. Suppose you reach someone who's super skeptical and say, what about those maybe 10 or 15% of scholars who kind of disagree with 3 of these 5? Okay, fine. What about 1? Fact number 1, they believed. Easy to remember, right? They believed, meaning the existence of the disciples' belief in the supernatural bodily resurrection of Jesus is basically an uncontested fact among historians. No scholar, pretty much no scholar that I know of, even Robert Price, believes that the disciples did not believe. In other words, everybody thinks the disciples believed Jesus rose again. So the question is, how do you explain the rise of belief in the disciples? How do you explain that? If every scholar, every historian holds that Jesus resurrected, or that the disciples actually believed he resurrected, then what is the most logical reason or source of that belief? That's the question you have to ask. So scholar and theologian N.T. Wright and William Lane Craig basically used this line of reasoning. I have separate books from them. They didn't collaborate, but I put their argument together for you so you can pay me later. But this is basically what it turns out to be. And here, let me read a couple quotes first. we are left with the conclusion that the combination of the empty tomb and appearances of the living Jesus forms a set of circumstances which is itself both necessary and sufficient for the rise of Christian belief. So he's saying that once you have the belief and you try to explain where they got it from, all you need to do is point to the empty tomb and the appearances, and then you get there. You can trace a line from these things to the belief of Jesus. Jesus' bodily resurrection. So in other words, if you're looking back trying to explain where their belief came from because you know they had it, you have to figure out how did that develop, and it's easily, the development of the belief is easily seen when you take the empty tomb and the appearances. They both, when taken together, form necessary and sufficient conditions for the rise of belief. Philosopher and theologian William Lane Craig notes that whatever they may think of the historical resurrection, even the most skeptical scholars admit that at least the belief that Jesus rose from the dead lay at the very heart of the earliest Christian faith. So N.T. Wright, what he does is he creates, I didn't write this here, but he has seven steps that he takes the reader on, and basically it's summarized in this statement here, but the seven steps gets to this one fact that they believed. And all you have to do then is try to explain that, and then you have a reason for the belief that makes sense. You can't explain their belief any other way. This is the problem. You can't explain the belief with any other source than the bodily resurrection of Jesus. So the primary premise here of their line of thought is that the disciples believed Jesus was bodily resurrected from the dead. Okay, so that's their main point. Secondary premise A, the belief could have been caused by seeing visions of the raised Jesus, like hallucinations, or seeing the actual resurrected Jesus in bodily form. So it could have been caused by either one of these things. And they're saying the belief could not have been caused by seeing visions of the raised Jesus, like we saw in the hallucination portion of our conversation. So therefore, they saw the actual resurrected Jesus in bodily form. So what they're saying is the disciples believed he was bodily raised from the dead. That belief could have arisen either from hallucinations or an actual bodily raised Jesus. And then they're saying it could not have been from hallucinations, therefore it must have been from a bodily raised Jesus. So this is kind of their line of thought. And it's pretty simple. It's an either-or form of logic known as a disjunctive syllogism. And it presents the argument really quickly and easily. And all that you need to know is, to start with, is the fact that is uncontested among scholars, is that the disciples had a belief. And this is very simple. It's like, okay, well, everyone says they have a belief. Where did the belief come from? Where did it come from? So, okay, so we're kind of running out of time. On the next page, I'm just saying a few things here. I'll quickly read through these five items. After we realize the disciples had a belief, what did they do? They started preaching this view. So all scholars attest to the fact that the resurrection message was spread. They started preaching about it. It was the point, not just a point of the preaching, but the point of the preaching in the early church. And it was proclaimed in Jerusalem, where Jesus died and was buried shortly before. This is important. If anyone questioned their testimony, they were around to back it up and check the facts with other eyewitnesses. Okay? So it was preached, and it was preached in Jerusalem. So we know that the view was deep in the disciples to the point that they wanted to preach it and tell others. They really, really, really believed Jesus bodily rose. So additionally, the first speech in Acts is in the very city of Jerusalem, where Jesus was just killed 50 days before, so there were eyewitnesses nearby who would know of what just took place. So likewise, if the tomb wasn't empty, no movement could have been founded because the body would have been pointed to. People knew that the body would have been in the grave, and so the movement would have been shut down. But there was no body in the tomb, which explains the movement arising in the very city of Jerusalem where Jesus just was killed. If their report of what took place was a lie, then Christianity would not have succeeded in Jerusalem, but it did. So we see the point of the early preaching was successful. Jesus rose from the grave. It wasn't challenged by the production of a dead body, and thus we have the emergence of Christianity. So this is an uncontested fact among scholars. Every scholar agrees to this sequence of events. They're preaching. The point of the preaching was the resurrection, and the resurrection was in Jerusalem, and it wasn't challenged by the production of a dead body, so we see the emergence of the church. And this is what is undeniable. No scholar denies that. It's just, how do you explain this preaching? How do you explain this deep-rooted belief? You can't explain it in any other way. A no hallucination hypothesis will do. The only explanation that makes sense and has explanatory power and scope is the resurrection itself. So thus, with this one fact, you can easily trace it back to the resurrection, and that was the rise of belief in the disciples. So I'll leave you with that. And you have, I think, now a lot of tools in your tool belt to use to help you with the resurrection. The next chunk here, the next five pages, is rather minimal. Perhaps you can even read it on your own time. Maybe we'll get to it and read through it next time, I'm not sure. But if you can, I'd like you to read this on your own and get familiar with these last pieces of evidence. These are what I'm calling circumstantial indirect evidence supporting the approaches above. So these are just additional things we can bring up that are in addition to those 12 facts. These are facts that relate to kind of the emergence of the church, the rise of the modified resurrection theory, the persecution of the church, yet its continual growth and expansion, and also the disciples dying for their belief. So these are kind of aftermath pieces of evidence that we can use to look back again and say, what was the cause of this? What was the source of this? No other theory makes sense except for the resurrection. That's what I'm trying to do here. And at the end, I have implications of the resurrection view. How does this apply to us? How does it change our life? And how does it affect the world as a whole, even in our modern day? So those are the points I'm trying to make at the end. And with that, are there any questions? Okay. So if anything didn't make sense or you wanted to chat about something, just come chat afterwards. Otherwise, we can close in prayer. Would anybody like to close us in prayer? Okay, thanks, Steve.